Hey, welcome. I'm Chris Lopez, host of the Valley Pod, where we talk to all the interesting people of the San Luis Valley. Joining us in our studio on the south side of Alamosa is Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser. We have a few things we'd like to talk to you about. Welcome, sir.
Chris, it's great to be back.
Welcome to the best weather in Colorado. I called it Goldilocks weather, not too hot, not too cold, just right.
Spectacular. It's apparently 100 degrees in Denver today, but here it's nice and cool.
Yeah, that's why you want to come down to the San Luis Valley. You were in the town of San Luis earlier this week on your trip here to hear community concerns around the tall fence being constructed around Cielo Vista Ranch and La Sierra. Here it was an energetic town meeting. What was your takeaway? What resonated with you? What were your personal takeaways?
There's a lot about that meeting I'm still processing. The point that I continue to pay attention to, over 70 people showed up in the middle of a workday in a county that has 1,000 people. That's an extraordinary statement in and of itself. Second, there were strong emotions in that room. Points were made about this fence in terms of its impact on spiritual and religious practice, access to a cemetery, the message that this fence is sending to community members, the impact it's having on wildlife, on water, on access to firewood. This is a generational challenge that unfortunately is not a new one. There's been litigation on what has been known as the Taylor Ranch litigation now for decades, and I was joined in the meeting by Jerome DiHerrera, a friend who's representing the community to preserve access to what has been long promised in terms of wildlife, wood, and resources for grazing and for recreation. The message that I want to leave the community with is my commitment to being there to listen, to work with them, and to be a public servant for them is one that it was clear they had real concerns whether or not the state of Colorado has their back, is listening, is engaged. And my takeaway is it's really important that I show up to listen, that I be a trusted partner with the county and with the community, and we're committed to that.
Yeah, no doubt that is. There's a lot of passion in that community. Earlier this week, the grocery conglomerate Kroger Company and Albertsons released a list of stores they plan to divest from if their merger is finalized, once their merger is finalized. The Safeway store in Alamosa is on the list to be sold and end up in the hands of CNS Wholesale Grocers, which really doesn't run retail stores. It's a supply chain as a wholesale grocer. Tell us about the merger, where the Federal Trade Commission is in its review, and where the state of Colorado is in its effort to block the merger.
I came here a year ago. Chris, I think we had a chance to visit after I had a town hall. The message I heard at that town hall was clear. There are three options for groceries here in Alamosa: a City Market, a Safeway, and a Walmart. This merger would be, in antitrust terms, a 3-2 merger. The idea that this Safeway store could be divested to an unknown entity and potentially closed down is a scary one. There's a precedent that is very much on my mind, which was a prior merger between Safeway and Albertsons, where divested stores to another fairly unknown entity, that entity was called Hagen's, led to a bankruptcy of Hagen's, closing down of stores, and some of the stores got sold back to the merge firm, then known as Albertsons. Previously, we knew them as Albertsons and Safeway. I'm fighting this merger in court. We've got a hearing in August, and our request is simple. Stop this merger. We believe it's going to harm communities. It's going to harm consumers. It'll harm farmers and producers, and it's going to harm workers. So this is a merger that we see as a violation of the antitrust laws. That's where we're fighting it in court here in Colorado. There's another case in federal court where the Federal Trade Commission is also challenging the merger. We're not putting our hands in the feds, though. We're taking matters into our own hands.
So August court hearing.
That's correct.
There are two U.S. Supreme Court rulings recently that we want to ask you about. One where the court backed up the executive branch of the federal government on a dispute between Texas and New Mexico regarding the Rio Grande Compact, and seemingly in that decision strengthened the hand of the federal government in managing water and intervening in disputes between states on interstate water compacts. The other interesting Supreme Court ruling was around homelessness. Let's take up the Rio Grande Compact decision first and your analysis of that 5-4 ruling by the justices.
I want to emphasize the particular facts of this case, which are unique. There was a prior decision where the Supreme Court said the United States had a right to proceed in this matter, and the majority opinion effectively said that ruling stands, nothing has changed, the U.S. has a right to proceed. I think that ruling is formalistic, is wrong, but it's limited because of the unique situation. The broader point that you touched on is the one the dissent got to, the big picture. The Reclamation Act and the role of the federal government in managing water is very unique in federal law. It is the only area I know about where the federal government has committed to live under state law. Water rights that exist within Colorado when we store water in a federal reservoir remain governed by Colorado law, by Colorado water agreements, and the feds don't get to say, as they often get to say, we're the federal government, we get to do what we want. They have to live under state law, and that is a unique situation. The dissent made that point. I think the broader point you're making remains to be seen. Will the feds get an upper hand in other cases, or is this really a unique situation where you had a prior ruling that is going to be honored in a slightly different circumstance? I think it shouldn't have been, but I recognize the prior ruling made this case complicated and unique.
How does that case move forward in a settlement between Texas, New Mexico? Colorado's off to the side, but you are a party to it all. How does the case, do they have to go back to negotiations, those two states? What happens now?
There is a special master in this case. It will be remanded to the special master. The question to the special master will be how to flesh out what the federal government is asking for. Our view is that the dispute that originated this case, which is really between Texas and New Mexico, as you said, we're on the side, that's now resolved. They have a plan that they're comfortable with. So the question for the United States is, what about that plan don't you like? What do you want? And it's not clear to me what the U.S.'s answer will be when we get back for the special master. That's going to be probably the first question that gets asked.
The court also dealt with camping bans in a ruling that municipalities like Alamosa, like Denver, and everywhere else can ban people from sleeping and camping in public spaces. What's the upshot of that ruling for cities in Colorado?
The most important point is there is no restriction on camping bans that protect the public's right to ensure that public property remains accessible to the public. This case does not, and this has been, I believe, a misimpression, allow the criminalization of homelessness per se. And the reason I say that is, if you had a case where there was not enough shelter opportunity for homeless individuals, there was a ban on parking and sleeping in your car anywhere in the city, and there was no public area in the local environment that you could camp if you were homeless, then we're getting to a situation that meets the description of you're criminalizing someone being homeless, which I find that to me, a really problematic situation if it were to occur. That doesn't describe what's happening in Denver today or other places in Colorado that I know of. Rather, like the facts were from this case, it's, to me, an uncomfortable situation for someone to say, I can camp anywhere I want, and the impact to maybe private property holders, maybe the public, is irrelevant. And the Supreme Court said it's not irrelevant. It is a relevant consideration for governments to say there are certain areas that we need to keep open to the public, and if you're camping there, that's trespassing.
So in the scenario for a community like Alamosa, which is a regional provider of homeless services, provides a homeless encampment on public property over by the Alamosa Recreation. They've established St. Benedict's Camp. For a community like that that's taken steps to address its homeless population or provide services. I'm assuming it's status quo.
That is my assumption, too. All this said is where you limit public access in certain areas, you're within your rights to do so, and there's nothing in the Constitution that gets in the way of it. To the extent there are provisions to make sure that people can have shelter, can camp in certain areas, or can park their cars, leaving their cars, there's nothing about this case that would disturb those arrangements.
I want to turn to community safety and a feeling that a variety of people we talk to say they don't feel safe. They don't feel safe going out in the evenings. They worry about the homeless population they see. Alamosa is home to a community corrections center. Alamosa is home to the 12th Judicial Probation Office in town. And it seems that all of these factors contribute to the perception people have that their community is not safe. What is your general response to people when they say they don't feel safe in their own town?
My response is to be really concerned. One of the foremost responsibilities of government is to protect public safety. When people say they don't feel safe as an elected official, my reaction is to ask, what's leading you to feel that way? And what would feeling safe look like? What would it take to feel safe? One obvious question here is the role of policing. Do we have enough law enforcement presence? Is law enforcement operating effectively? Are we finding ways to prevent and get ahead of violence in particular, but crime more generally? There's a lot there in terms of taking that challenge on in public safety. And for those in the Valley who are working on public safety, I want them to know that I'm here as a partner to help provide state leadership. We did work hard on grant programs to recruit and retain more law enforcement officers. And I got a report yesterday from your sheriff and police chief here in Alamosa suggesting that that grant funding had been effective to help ensure a sufficient presence of police. George Stingfelder, your police chief here, is also the vice chair of our Peace Officer Standards and Training Program Board. We're leaning in hard to how we improve police training so that people can be safer and so that law enforcement can be a trusted and effective presence to make sure that we can both prevent crime, hold criminals accountable, and support those who are victims of crime.
What's your advice or your recommendation to a community that does have a community corrections facility in its town, is home to a probation office? And so, you know, we receive regional people coming in. People come because we're a regional city. We have these regional services. Homelessness is another one. And people don't like people from the outside, community corrections, probation, inmates, they feel that that creates an unsafe environment. But Alamos has always had that. And I don't have an answer for any of this. I just wonder how the state, the Attorney General's office, look at those types of regional placements, community corrections, probation, et cetera. I don't know how you get around that.
I would emphasize that there's an area that we need to do better in, which is preventing people who are reentering society, whether through community corrections, through the probation system, so they don't end up committing crimes. We know that those who leave prison and have a job, for example, are far less likely to commit crimes. We've been working to help support the development of a fair chance hiring effort. We're looking at what are ways we can prepare people for productive employment and life after they are incarcerated. Most people who are incarcerated in jail or prison are going to reenter society. If they reenter society and commit more crimes, that's a problem from a public safety perspective. That's a problem from even a, call it, humanitarian perspective. Maybe we haven't done enough to help people who don't have job skills get them. We're going to keep working on that issue. And we as a society need to recognize that we all have a stake in that challenge, because right now Colorado's recidivism rate, the likelihood someone commits a crime after they leave, is close to, let's say, 48% or so. The national average is around 34%. So we do have to get better in that area, and we are working on it, and there's a lot of important work to be done.
From a state perspective, from a perspective of the state attorney general, is it fair to ask a community like Alamosa to be a regional hub of these types of services, state release programs, and should there be extra dollars that come into a community that is a regional provider for these types of programs and services?
Alamosa is definitely a regional hub here in the Valley for a lot of services, and the ones you mentioned are part of that. There are benefits that come from being a regional hub, and there are costs that come from it. On balance, if we're doing the work the right way, supporting this region and having Alamosa play this leadership role, this is in general an opportunity for Alamosa. I was having conversations today about behavioral health and support for young people, youth mental health, and Alamosa is a regional hub in that area as well. I appreciate the spirit of collaboration in the Valley and that people here in Alamosa don't see themselves on an island. They see themselves, to take the metaphor, archipelago, connected to other islands where they have a shared interest in how they work together as a network. And that's true in all these areas.
I think it's helpful for you to address that as you did, and helpful for us as a community media organization to help people understand the regional nature of Alamosa and why we see people coming into the probation office through the 12th Judicial. We see people being placed in community corrections. We see people coming in for the services La Puente and the city of Alamosa provide around homeless. I think that's the part most community members don't understand or recognize, that regional service provider part. I think that's one that they can't get their head around.
This community in Alamosa is critical to the broader Valley community, and there are interesting challenges from all sides. People in Antonito may say people are not going to Alamosa to do their shopping, which is bringing people in commerce to Alamosa that's not in Antonito, and that's a tension that comes at the question you asked from the other side. I believe this Valley has that collaborative spirit where people see themselves as part of a broader whole, and issues of concern. We talked about this fence that's near San Luis. That's something that is a concern to people here in Alamosa too, because of that spirit of we're all in it together.
Yeah. There were a couple of incidents earlier this summer that have definitely contributed to the community feeling unsafe. We had a situation in June where sheriff deputies around midnight spotted a vehicle and a person they were of interest in, and that person fled, abandoned their car in a nearby neighborhood, and a chase ensued between three sheriff deputies and the suspect. The suspect was in the front yard of a neighborhood home around midnight. The three sheriff deputies opened fire on him, wounded him with two bullets, and many others hit the home. One bullet flew into the front window, into the bedroom window of the couple sleeping, hit their car with bullets. Does police, law enforcement training tell you to open fire that way? I know that might be unfair to put you into that situation of that question, but the question is around training of law enforcement officers.
Let me first say, I'm not going to talk about an individual case. I know there's ongoing inquiries in that case. And we talked about this last year, and it's obviously now more relevant in Alamosa because I talked about George Dingfelder, who then was in Monte Vista. He's now here in Alamosa. He implemented a program called Active Bystander in Law Enforcement. And that program creates a mindset among all law enforcement of, I have responsibilities for my fellow officers as bystanders. His implementation of that Monte Vista led to a, and I believe he related it as a 50% decrease in officer-involved shooting activity, or maybe use of force. I'm not sure which of the two. That's a remarkable statistic. And what it says to your question is how important training is. The right forms of training are more likely to produce peaceful outcomes because officers don't escalate situations unnecessarily. We're looking at that issue in the in-service training area with trainings like this active bystander law enforcement, as well as we redesign the police academy training. This is part of an overall project that we're committed to and that we see as very promising. And I know you've probably had George on before and we'll have him on again. Mm-hmm. He's happy to talk about that. I know he's going to bring that same program here to Alamosa as well.
Earlier, your office released a list of school districts and schools, Alamosa's among them, BOCES, San Luis Valley's among them, that received funding to address vaping on school campuses. Talk to us about that particular situation and problem that you see there, and then the work that you're doing around mental health and youth.
Right before this, Chris, I was with a number of leaders here in the Valley who talked about youth mental health. Aaron Miltenberger, the head of your Boys and Girls Club, convened the conversation, and a number of the awardees of these grants were there, including the Boys and Girls Club, who got money through the statewide Boys and Girls Club.
Right.
So 44,000, meaning the Valley got overall 860,000 from these first set of grants. And these are because, as Aaron put it, young people are really hurting. There's a lot of anxiety that young people are struggling with, and vaping is one way they seek to treat it. People are bringing these vape pens with them into school, and they're constantly vaping. You might actually say the same thing about phones. Smartphones are being used and these social media apps in a way to treat anxiety, but vaping and smartphones have a similar problem. People turn to them feeling anxious, maybe a little isolated or lonely, and they feel even worse after they vape or after they are on their phone. We're working hard on both these issues to help people find healthier, more productive ways to address anxiety, to build connections. And we're working to address this social media problem by suing Meta, who's pushed these notifications out, who have algorithms that bring young people down dark holes. Young girls are twice as likely, for example, to see self-harm content as others. We're really concerned. And with the other part of the money we have from this Juul settlement, we're going to call for school community partnerships to develop holistic responses to support healthier young people. I just talked to a number of people about that opportunity. I'm looking forward to what the Valley can put together, because this Valley does have, as we talked about earlier, a real sense of collaboration and people being in it together. And as I got to see the network of people working on youth mental health, it's really impressive.
You know, when you look at vaping, you look at those types of products, you look at social media, you look at those types of products, one of the things that comes out is the targeting of people at certain ages, certain demographics, by tobacco companies, by social media companies, by sellers of vaping products. It's the advertisement that directs at people, particular demographics, particular ages, age populations, that really has the effect of influence. Is there anything the state of Colorado, the Attorney General's office, is doing in that space of advertising, direct product marketing? Because really, that's where things happen, in that marketing, advertising space.
Let me offer three responses to a very important point, Chris, you just made. First, the lawsuit against Juul was premised on the exact harm that you talked about. They were targeting teens, saying it's cool to Juul, and they use social media to do it. Under the resolution of that case, where we won not just $32 million, there's now requirements that they don't do that anymore. Number two, the lawsuit against Meta, who owns Facebook and Instagram, also makes the same point, including that Meta is violating a federal law, the Child Online Privacy Protection Act, that says you can't market to kids under 13. The documents from Meta, we put them in our complaint, people can read it online, make very clear that they did market deliberately to young people because they saw that as part of their economic feature. They needed the basically subscriber base, which is the same thing that Juul was doing. In fact, right now, it's interesting, rates of vaping have gone down a little bit among teenagers, but they're still higher among young adults because those are the people who were hooked earlier during these tactics. Finally, people can buy fentanyl online too now.
Mm.
And there are sellers who are able to reach out to young people via social media to sell fentanyl. And we're working to crack down on social media companies. We've pushed for legislation. We wrote a report on this that will address what we see as a huge problem, that it's as easy to order fentanyl online as it is to order a pizza.
What's the update? What's the latest on the state of Colorado's efforts to crack down on fentanyl use, on the manufacturing of synthetic drugs by Mexican cartels, which we know is a thing in a way they're making billions these days? How are you attacking or addressing the head of the problem versus the people who consume and use it?
We have to address this fentanyl crisis on every front. And the last 3 years, more people died of drug overdoses, increasingly fentanyl, than ever before in American history. The cartels and the distribution problem is real. We have devoted resources to cracking down on such cartels and illegal distribution of fentanyl. We'll keep doing that. That's a crucial role for our office. We push for legislation so that if you're selling drugs to somebody, fentanyl to somebody, and they die because of an overdose, you now have committed a felony. That is a crime in Colorado under state law. A number of DAs are now pursuing that. We're committed to holding those who push this drug accountable. We're also worried about this online access point. It makes it easier to distribute drugs when you can do it online as opposed to having to show up in places where you could be spotted. That's something that we need more cooperation from the social media platforms, and we'll keep pushing hard on that. I do want to pick up the point about users, because part of the reason that we have so many sellers is there is demand for fentanyl. And one of the scary parts of this crisis is if people don't get well, if they don't get treatment and recovery, they're very likely to overdose and die. And what we need to do better at, and part of why I'm here in the Valley now, is we need to provide more treatment. When I was here 7 years ago, Robert Jackson, the sheriff, and I talked about this crisis, and he said 90% of people who are in the Alamos County Jail were struggling with opioid addiction. He said, we need a treatment center here. Well, I'm here right now, and later today, we're going to be at the Hope of the Valley opening, the first treatment center here in generations, so that we can get people well. They're not going to be buying this product. They're not going to be going in and out of jail. That's a big deal for this county.
You know, one of the interesting things about the times we live in the society we're in right now is we talk about the challenges as we have, and there's several of them, but there's also a lot of success out there. There's a lot of people doing good. There's a lot of active, productive Coloradoans out there in the San Luis Valley. How do you, as the Attorney General, contrast all the good that we do see with the challenges, and how you balance that in your own approach, in your own messages, in your own life?
It's very important that we acknowledge the challenges that are there. People who are struggling, people who are facing trauma, anxiety, that's real. I want people to know that I'm listening. I also am an optimist. I grew up with that as part of my family's ethic. My mom and grandparents are Holocaust survivors and came to the United States believing in what our nation offers, which I view as freedom and opportunity for everybody. I just was talking to your assistant superintendent, Luis Murillo, who talked about his family story as the American dream. He also is an American by choice and is someone who believes in what America offers. And what he's doing in the schools here in Alamos is extraordinary. He talked about a program developed by a student to help people build better minds, minds in shape, I think is what it's called. And it's about being open that we all have mental health growth opportunities, and we should not stigmatize a conversation about our mental health. We should be willing to improve how we view the world, our mindsets. And that student who developed that is now a Betcher Scholar. That's a pretty inspiring program to me. The Hope in the Valley opening is in part because you have an extraordinary county commissioner here, Lori Lasky, who forged a leadership path, got funding that we were able to help make available because of our opioid settlements, helped able to find a good partner. And this is a big deal for the whole state because we need much more treatment. And here in the Valley, the whole team, and it's a great group that Lori's the chair of, your regional oversight council, there's a lot of people with lived experience who are part of this who said we need more treatment. So I look at those positive stories and I think this is what we need to be doing. There's a joke about this optimist that I often think about. Someone goes into a barn and there's a whole lot of manure and says, oh, it smells terrible. Another person goes in and says, oh, there must be a pony in here somewhere. So I'm more of that second person. I'm seeing the pony. And here in the valley, there are a lot of ponies that I'm excited about. And I leave here inspired by that.
Yeah, that's really a nice note. We really appreciate you always coming by and giving us some of your time. Before we let you go, we should ask if there's anything else you'd like to add or anything you'd like to ask us. But again, we really appreciate your time and that you give to us.
The conversation we just had picked up a nice thread that I'll lift up. It's something I think about from my religious tradition, which is we don't have the obligation to repair the world, to solve world hunger, if you will, by ourselves. But we're not free to desist from doing our part. Each of us has a part we can play in addressing youth mental health challenges, in addressing the opioid crisis, in improving public safety. And all of us can and should lean in and think, what is our part? How do we work together? I believe that's what the Valley does so well, and that's what Colorado does.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. It's a very nice note to leave on. Hey, you've been listening to the Valley Pod in our episode with Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser. Thank you for listening. The Valley Pod is produced by Owen Woods. It's part of the AlamosaCitizen.com podcast lineup. See you around the Valley.
Are you craving adventure? Step back in time with the entire family aboard the Cumbres and Toltec Scenic Railroad. Discover breathtaking mountain views and savor the historic charm on the longest and highest steam railroad in America. Feel the thrill of history come alive as you ride along the same tracks laid in 1880. All aboard for the 2024 season. Trains depart Tuesday through Sunday from Antonito, Colorado and Chama, New Mexico. Antonito train station is located just 30 miles south of Alamosa. Book today at CumbresToltec.com or call 888-286-2737.